How can you better support your patient's brain health? Tune into our FX Medicine Perspectives Forum, a live panel discussion packed with clinical pearls on hormones, movement, the gut-brain axis, and more. Watch the recording by logging into bioceuticals.com.au/education and walk away with practical insights you can use in clinic right away.
And welcome to FX Medicine by Bioceuticals, where we bring you the latest in evidence-based, integrative, functional, and complementary medicine. FX Medicine by Bioceuticals acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia, where we live and work, and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respect to their elders past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. With us today is Dr. Lara Bryden, a well-known naturopathic doctor, keynote speaker, and best-selling author. Today, we're going to discuss androgen excess and androgen sensitivity. Welcome to FX Medicine by Bioceuticals, Lara. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Emma. Looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, me too. Now, to get things started, Let's begin with, what are androgens and what role do they play in health?
Yeah, good starting point. So, of course, they're steroid hormones, primarily testosterone and DHEA would be the two biggest ones. Androstenedione is another one. And they're classically labeled as male hormones, which they are because men have about 10 or 20 times more than females, but of course they are also very important in the female body, and they do lots of jobs. You know, they support libido, mood, muscle mass. And then, of course, that's a spectrum as well, because there's a variation. There's a variant of normal in that. I mean, some women are just hairier than others. That's just genetic. But, of course, it's at a certain point, it crosses the line into hirsutism, acne, particularly strong jawline acne or breakouts, a particular kind of hair loss, which is this thinning, the kind of widening of the heart, miniaturization of the hair follicles. And then, of course, other signs, indirect signs, would be weight gain around the middle, menstrual irregularity. That starts to get into the territory of polycystic ovary syndrome, which, of course, we're going to talk about.
Okay, fantastic. And how are they best measured? Is it done by blood? Is it saliva? What point of the menstrual cycle? What time of day? There's so many variables, but what gives us the best information?
Yeah, well, I use serum testing. Again, serum is not perfect, but I will say that my view is saliva testing is not, cannot be used for testosterone. There's some reasons for that. I think saliva testing has some variability built in with regard to androgens in particular that is sort of unacceptable from a clinical perspective. So serum testing, I would typically measure sometimes testosterone, SHBG, and also DHEAS, which is the DHEA sulfate. Keeping in mind, well, all androgens are age-dependent, but DHEAS very much so is on an age gradient, because all people, males and females, have higher levels of androgens when we're younger, and then they decline over time. So we have to factor that in. And then I guess in terms of the menstrual phase, they don't fluctuate. My understanding is they don't fluctuate hugely with the menstrual cycle. I mean, not like estradiol and progesterone, of course, but in general, I think most clinicians try to test early in the follicular phase. It's probably when androgens are at their highest. So, you know, days 2 to 5, kind of.
Okay, great. So serum testing, generally testosterone, SHBG, DHEAS in the early part of the menstrual cycle, day 2 to 5. Perfect. Okay. Now, polycystic ovarian syndrome is one of the major causes of elevated androgens, and I was reading a 2023 paper that looked at the prevalence of PCOS, and it concluded that 5.2% of American women had clinically diagnosed PCOS. Can you explain briefly how the pathology of PCOS affects androgen levels?
Yeah. Well, I guess I would phrase it this way. PCOS, depending on which diagnostic criteria you use, so there's a whole controversy built into that. But PCOS is, by definition, the condition of androgen excess when all other causes of androgen excess have been ruled out. It's an exclusion diagnosis. So, and they're different. And within that, there are potentially different biological drivers of the androgen excess. The classic PCOS, most of the androgens are coming from the ovaries as part of an ovulatory disturbance where sort of higher testosterone, reduced ovulation rates, higher LH, reduced aromatase activity. So that's kind of the classic picture of PCOS. But the label PCOS can apply to all sorts of different women, including women who have high adrenal androgens.
Mm.
So that's actually quite a different pathophysiology. I've written about this quite a lot, the sort of the different functional types of PCOS. It's PCOS is an umbrella diagnosis, if that's helpful for people. It's really just the diagnosis of androgen excess, I would say, except in the case of the Rotterdam criteria, which permits a non-androgenic PCOS subtype, which I just reject. And some experts would equally reject that. That's sort of confusing, muddying the water. That doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And apart from the ovarian androgen excess, what are other causes of elevated androgens that we should keep in mind?
Yeah, there's lots of different causes. So, of course, there are adrenal androgen excess. That's the adrenal type of PCOS. You can have adrenal tumors. I mean, that's a bit more rare. You could have what's called late onset congenital adrenal hyperplasia, which is downstream from the various gene variants. That's often a misdiagnosis. That'll often be originally diagnosed as PCOS until, you know, further investigation might reveal that it's actually adrenal hyperplasia. That the classic test for that would be screening for something called 17-hydroxyprogesterone. Mm. So that's a different serum test. You can have androgen excess downstream from high prolactin.
Mm-hmm.
You can have androgen excess from various medications, including certain antipsychotic medications. And of course, you can also have androgen excess from progestins or components of hormonal birth control that are androgenic or derived from testosterone. So there's lots going on, and this is why PCOS, back to the, you know, most of the official diagnosis of PCOS, it has a key criteria in any of the diagnostic criteria is to eliminate other explanations for androgen excess.
Mm, and I think that's a great point, that it is an exclusion diagnosis, and we don't need to jump straight to, oh, this is PCOS and this is the cause. There's many other reasons that we can be seeing this elevated androgen.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Okay, and then what about the metabolic consequences of chronically elevated androgens? What's actually going on?
Yeah, so this is where there's a very interesting sex difference.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite fascinating, actually. So in women, androgen excess promotes quite strongly insulin resistance and metabolic dysfunction. And that it becomes a vicious cycle, because then the hyperinsulinemia, or the chronically high insulin of insulin resistance, also promotes high androgens or high testosterone from the ovaries. So that is, for women, that happens. For men, it's the exact opposite. Men will, low androgens, or, you know, too low testosterone will promote insulin resistance. So it's quite a fascinating area of biology to kind of look into. I'm actually sort of trying to do a bit of a deep dive into that right now as part of a paper that I'm helping to co-author on the intricate sort of bi-directional relationship between insulin resistance and androgen excess in women specifically.
Mm. And, you know, we have patients coming in to see us, and one of the first things that they have as a complaint is this abdominal, this central weight gain. They find it really frustrating. It's the kind of weight that results in that thicker waist and sort of heavier upper body that doesn't shift easily.
Absolutely. So that's the classic visceral adiposity, or the increased volume of visceral fat that is strongly associated with, probably downstream from, insulin resistance. It's also directly induced by androgen excess in women. So that, as you say, it can be tricky to shift that. And I would say, as a clinician, really the only way to start to shift that is to lower androgens and also improve insulin sensitivity, which means lowering insulin. It's really the only way to sort of regain the narrower waist. Women, I mean, classically in a healthy state would have more of an hourglass shape, and that's largely because of sort of estradiol dominance. Mm. And estradiol promotes insulin sensitivity and the redistribution of fat from the middle to the lower body. Like the kind of classic gynoid fat distribution would be under the influence of higher estrogen and lower androgen.
I love that emphasis of, you know, really to get to the root problem and the root cause, we must aim our treatments to lower the androgens and lower the insulin. Yep. That's where we need to be focusing. But conversely, Lara, what are the consequences of chronically low androgens? Because I see this in a lot of my patients. I'm very surprised how often I'm seeing these low androgen states. But what's the problem with having low androgens for a woman?
Yeah. So let's explore that. And I'm actually curious enough to hear a little bit of your, you know, feedback as to what you see. But first, I'll just kind of share what I know about this. I mean, definitely, I know what you mean. I mean, you can, the more sort of classic signs of lower androgens in women would be lower mood, potentially lower libido. I've often observed that with a higher tendency to autoimmune type conditions, because androgens generally have an immune stabilizing. So this would be the population of patients who are kind of flaring up into different autoimmune. There'd be reduction in body hair. So you will have people who are just naturally quite lower in body hair, even to the point of, you know, losing pubic hair would be sort of a sign over time of lower androgens. The interesting thing, sort of just zooming out, is this work from a scientist called Bernard Cresty out of Canada, Vancouver, where he's looked at, I think he would phrase it as kind of prenatal programming of androgen levels. So there is sort of a blueprint that we're born with. It's going to be partially genetic, partially epigenetic, where, for example, we do know that female fetuses that are exposed to higher levels of androgens in utero will later, you know, grow into a woman with tending to higher androgens. And that can be obviously be associated with insulin resistance, PCOS, you know, weight gain, that all that side of things. Conversely, female fetuses who are exposed to lower androgens in utero are more likely to grow up with a tendency to autoimmune and endometriosis and heavier menstrual flow and things like that. So it is quite, I think we're sort of, you know, calibrated. And I think a lot of us clinicians can observe that. There's some women who are just, I've even said to patients, like, look, you're really just sort of low androgen person. Like they've almost usually been like that almost, you know, throughout all of their adult lives, you can see that, as opposed to, on the other side, women who are tending to higher androgens. So, and it's all, it's not a pathology in that sense I mean, it's a calibration. So it's all, there's adaptive mechanisms for both. So they can be, actually, what the literature shows is having that female physiology that's tending more to higher insulin, higher androgens, that's a survival mechanism. Those would have been people who were, you know, whose ancestors had to, you know, survive tough times and be able to reproduce in the, you know, in famine situations and things like that. So it's kind of a superpower, but of course, in our modern world, it can be quite, you know, difficult to manage.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel what I see clinically is the low energy states of these women that are presenting with these chronically low androgens. That's what they come in saying, look, I think my iron must be low, but, you know, it's been checked by my GP. I've been told that my thyroid and my iron is fine, but yet I'm still so exhausted. I'm sleeping reasonably well. I don't know what's wrong with me. That's the picture that I see a lot of in clinic.
Sure. Yeah, and so then you might pick up a low DHEAS or like kind of like a low normal reading, something like that. Yeah, I've seen similar. And like I said, it often goes hand in hand with, in my observation, some degree of kind of autoimmune something happening.
Yeah, very much so. And what about the concept of androgen sensitivity and how do you measure androgen sensitivity, like the receptors? I'm fascinated by this topic because I feel like we're at the tip of the iceberg with this information.
Well, as far as I know, I mean, you know, again, it could be something I'm not aware of, but I don't think there's any way to measure that. So androgen sensitivity would just be how responsive tissues in general or even specific tissues are to androgens. And that's going to be a lot to do with the local conversion of testosterone to DHT, the rate of that, which is from an enzyme called 5-alpha reductase, and then also the sensitivity of the androgen receptors themselves. And I think that can even vary from tissue to tissue. So certainly with things like hair loss or androgenic hair loss, you can get you know, individuals where their main symptom is just that their hair seems, their hair follicles be particularly sensitive to androgen. Mm. And it does clinically correlate with inflammation. So I have seen a few, you know, little studies suggesting inflammation could be upregulating androgen receptors, but I don't, I'm not aware of any way to test that.
Mm.
Apart from symptoms, I mean, again, it's a clinical diagnosis.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Well, I guess the future of medicine will reveal more over time on that side of things. But, you know, I'd really love to understand how we could manipulate that receptor sensitivity. You know, could we dial it up or could we dial it down? You know, does things like strength training influence the receptor sensitivity or our zinc levels? I see a lot clinically that I'm starting to ponder.
Well, a lot of things, I mean, we can, so yes, I think the receptor sensitivity can be modulated based on one of my favorite supplements for that is DIM. I think progesterone, like the body's own progesterone, body identical progesterone can also downregulate androgen receptors to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there's another step I mentioned, the 5 alpha reductase, the activation to DHT, that can definitely be regulated. And that's regulated by, again, zinc, progesterone. Which is why actually I've written a paper on cyclic progesterone therapy for PCOS, with some of the various androgen lowering benefits of progesterone. So some of the herbal medicines work by downregulating 5 alpha reductase. I think reishi mushroom might be in that category. So yeah, there's lots to be done there. In fact, I would say that natural medicine can do quite well in terms of some, you know, alleviating some of those androgen sensitivity symptoms, although it does take a long time. Anything to do with hair or skin just takes months. Like we're talking, you know, 6 to 12 or 24 months to really see any changes.
Mm, and that's good to counsel our patients because it is a time-sensitive matter, but it's not a time-sensitive solution.
Right. Oh, very well phrased, Emily. That's great. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then in relation to the relative androgen excess in perimenopause, because this is quite obvious in clinic, what's the best way to identify it and to kind of look at it? What framework should we be thinking of?
Yeah. So when you say it's quite obvious, I agree. You're talking about, you know, the increased facial hair, the weight gain around the middle, potentially acne even for some women in their 40s. Yeah. So it's a ratio issue. So I just to sort of, you know, for context, obviously we have quite a lot of androgen actually as women, but through our reproductive years, its effects are overshadowed, if you will, by both estradiol and progesterone, which both have anti-androgen properties.
Mm.
So through most of if you think about it this way, in the early stages of puberty, andrarchy is actually called, so, you know, women, girls go through a quite androgen dominant phase before estradiol and progesterone have kicked in, and then convert, and they will have, you know, sort of thickening around the waist. You've seen like 11-year-olds with that.
Yeah.
They get this little pre-puberty kind of thickening. They're getting facial body hair at that time. And then, you know, on the other side of it, what I call second puberty, as first progesterone and then estradiol start to drop away, you do get androgen shining through again. And that is one of the contributing drivers to the insulin resistance of perimenopause. It's not the only factor, but it's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And also, as we said, you know, more facial hair and things like that. So it can be quite frustrating. I mean, again, in terms of diagnosing that, it would be... Well, one actually really classic thing, just to bring in SHBG, we mentioned it at the start, but sex hormone binding globulin for women is a very useful test, I find. It's one of the hormone tests that I do quite a bit just to get a gauge on that, because in the classic situation of androgen dominance, SHBG will be low, or sex hormone binding globulin will be low, and that it can just be pushed down by androgens themselves, will lower SHBG, but so does reduced estrogens will result in lower SHBG, insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia pushes down on SHBG. The other thing that causes low SHBG and therefore relatively high androgens is hypothyroidism.
Mm.
So that's another factor in all of this. So getting a look at, you know, someone's SHBG, if it's below normal, on the very low end of normal, that can give you sort of a, you know, a diagnostic metric, but also kind of a signpost of, you know, if we could get SHBG up, that can really improve things. And there's lots of ways to get SHBG up, you know, improving insulin sensitivity, even things like phytoestrogens raise SHBG. I think that's one of the ways they benefit insulin sensitivity and PCOS and other things. that would even include soy. I mean, I know soy is super controversial. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of a soy agnostic. You know, I think it has a, you know, I think soy as a food has a place. It can definitely in women help to raise SHBG, which is good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great little clinical tip, is to look at the SHBG and see if it's at the lower end of normal, where, yeah, you know, there could be the androgen dominance, low estrogen, some insulin resistance, hypothyroidism, all of those things can cause lower SHBG. But then the use of therapeutic doses of phytoestrogens to help increase the SHBG, to help support that hormonal balance.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, definitely. The other thing that raises SHBG, is just kind of quirky, is coffee.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if people are coffee drinkers,
yeah,
they can, you know, be happy about that side benefit.
Yeah, it's a great justification for that one coffee a day, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Wonderful. Now, I do want to cover a very challenging clinical presentation, the one of female pattern hair loss or androgenic alopecia. I almost, when I see this on an intake form, I almost sort of cringe and go, oh my goodness, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
Like, I really struggle treating this, Lara. But first of all, you know, what causes it to occur, and then how can we address it?
Yes. I mean, it can happen at any age, but more classically, we're going to be seeing it after menopause, right? Mm, so once estradiol and progesterone drop away and their protective anti-androgen benefits are reduced, we start to see androgens shining through. And then, you know, women's response to that, how as to how likely they are to lose hair from that, it is going to depend on what we mentioned earlier, the sensitivity to those androgens, which some of them will be genetic for sure. I mean, you get that runs in families. So some people that like their mom had it and then they have it. I mean, that's just sort of one of their, you know, weak spots. I think, like I mentioned, inflammation can upregulate that sensitivity. I will just also point out there's another kind of postmenopausal hair loss, which is not the classic. So again, the female pattern hair loss is the classic kind of thinning parts, mm-hmm, and thinning everywhere. And there is a type of hair loss that where the front hairline just starts receding kind of directly back, not like in the male pattern, like on the sides, but like in the directly back. That actually can be linked more to an autoimmune condition. I think there's something called lichen planopilaris. So, I mean, it's worth, like with anything, it's worth trying to do a differential diagnosis and understand what could be affecting, I mean, what could be contributing. Obviously, there are then other non-androgen related drivers of hair loss, including hypothyroidism, that has to always be mentioned for women. That can just cause hair loss. There's the telogenic, like the, you know, the hair loss from undereating or stress, and that typically would have a 3 month, you know, whenever the stress is, 3 months later, you're going to see massive hair loss. So that needs to be interpreted correctly. I will just point out that another major driver of female pattern hair loss is, I mentioned earlier, but progestins that are androgenic, the strongest one is levonorgestrel, which is in the hormonal IUD, and some of the implants, it's in some of the pills, although if it's in a pill combined with synthetic estrogen, its androgenic effects will be less because it's buffered by estrogen. But those all classically promote female pattern hair loss. They promote miniaturization of hair follicles.
Oh, dear.
So especially in people who already have a genetic predisposition to that and estrogen sensitivity, having had years on those types of progestins can cause this female pattern hair loss. It's quite a heartbreaking cause, I think, because it was preventable.
Yes.
The other thing to understand about the miniaturization that happens to hair follicles in the under the influence of androgens, it's irreversible after a point. So it's depending on, and so people can talk to their specialist, like they can do a kind of follicle test where it's, I think they actually look at the follicle, like they pull a hair and sort of look at it under the microscope, and they can see to what degree miniaturization has occurred. Mm-hmm. And that, unfortunately, can be irreversible. So that would be the case too for years on a progestin. If the female pattern hair loss is from that, and then a woman heads into menopause, I don't know. I'm not sure there's any coming back from that really, which is hard, you know, confronting. But if it's shorter term and it's only been, you know, a year or two, I think that it can be reversed. That's my understanding.
But it is very common for women to be on, you know, progesterone in the pill or the Mirena or Kylena. It is extremely common. And it may be a discussion that we have with our patients possibly when they're a bit younger, about birth control options of, you know, what the pros and cons of each are.
Well, exactly. And, you know, that's a lot of my work has been trying to bring that discussion into the mainstream, is really questioning what are we doing with this routine prescription of these contraceptive medications, which have far-reaching implications. So there was actually just a study, and we could put this in the show notes, that came out, it's quite startling, came out about 6 months ago, where they looked at the skin and hair side effects from progestin-only methods, including the hormonal IUD, and it was, yeah, with hirsutism, acne, female pattern hair loss, exactly as you would expect from an androgenic substance. And it was quite significant. I mean, so obviously not all women experience, that's an example of sensitivity, right? Like, so some women can have that medication and not really develop any androgen symptoms from it. And some women are very sensitive. And that's what we talked about before, genetic sensitivity.
Absolutely. I was at a conference on the weekend, Lara, and Leia Heckman did a presentation. And in that presentation, there was some brain imaging and of how the oral contraceptive pill affects different parts of the brain. And I found it fascinating how some parts of the brain are upregulated and others are downregulated due to the effects of the pill.
Of course. Well, the brain is extremely hormone sensitive, and the medications in the pill are not human hormones. So we're going to obviously, you know, like the brain, and this has been dead. I'd be curious to see Leia's slides. I'll have to sort of try to ask her for those or look that up. But I mean, it has been emerging in the research that, well, for example, we know the brain changes shape in different phases of the menstrual cycle. It changes shape with pregnancy. And like any kind of hormonal influence actually affects the brain quite a lot, which makes total sense. And so then if you put into the mix molecules that are quite different from human hormones, their effect on the brain is going to be quite different from human hormones. It's obviously, you know, cannot mimic them. So it's troubling. It is actually very, very troubling when we think about how widespread these medications are and how little we know about them and how we're just starting to, you know, consider things like that.
Absolutely. It bothers me a lot. I mean, actually, that's a good segue. Let's shift the focus to the treatment options. Now, study I looked at pathological conditions that cause androgen excess in about 1,280 patients, and concluded that PCOS was the key driver in over 80% of cases. Anti-androgen hormonal therapy was used as treatment, and after an average of nearly 3 years, symptoms of, as we've just spoken, hirsutism, acne, and menstrual irregularities improved in about 80% of cases, but more than 60% experienced significant side effects. Now, we see this clinically, but I do think we need to be aware of all the tools at our disposal to help women. Can you talk us through the medical treatments usually offered to women who present with excess androgens?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about what you just said there. So, of course, yes, the oral contraceptive pill is the gold standard treatment for androgen excess, aka PCOS. Like I said, PCOS is really just the umbrella term for androgen excess when there's no other obvious explanation. So yeah, it does account for the majority of androgen excess cases. Contraceptive medication is good at lowering androgens, for sure. So some progestins, well, so first of all, the synthetic estrogen lowers androgens, upregulates SHBG, sometimes to 3 times higher than normal. So that's definitely androgen suppressing. In fact, when we talked earlier about androgen insufficiency, the most common cause of that actually is hormonal medication, like hormonal birth control as well. But yes, there's very little doubt that synthetic estrogen and anti-androgen progestins like drosperinone and ciprofloxacin can reduce androgens, for sure. And they... one of the think part of the quote you read there, it also regulates menstrual cycles. They don't do that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of my other big talking points, is the induced bleed that you get on the combined pill is not a menstrual cycle. It's just a bleed. Like, it's a menstrual cycle is about, you know, ovulation and ovarian function, and the contraceptive pill shuts that off, switches that off. So there's actually no medical reason to bleed monthly on combined birth control. So that's just kind of a weird thing that's baked into the current narrative, that you take the pill to regulate menstrual cycles, which obviously it can't do. But coming back to, yeah, the sort of the use of the pill for PCOS, it's like, it's great for symptom relief, but it does nothing to correct the underlying problem. And actually the an even worse problem is when you then try to stop it, especially stopping those progestins, drosperinone and cyclotron, you can get, and I've written about this quite extensively, you can get like a post-pill androgen surge. So while you're on those medications that are suppressing androgens, the body upregulates androgen production in response to that. It's like, oh dear, like what is going, going on here? We need to try to pump up. And then when you remove that medication and you remove that inhibition, androgen surge. And I'm sure we've all seen this clinically. It's very distressing. You'll get the classic post-pill acne, post-Yasmin usually. So Yasmin is the drosperinone pill. You will, it won't, it's not immediate. It takes at least minimum 3 months. And then between somewhere between sort of 3 to 9 months off the pill, women will get skin breakouts like they have never seen before. Like they might have gone on the pill originally for skin, but then when they try to come off, it's just a nightmare.
Yeah.
And that's the androgen upregulation. And of course, because women, I don't know what your patients are like, but most of the women I work with blame themselves. Like whatever's happening, they're like, oh my goodness, I must be broken. Like I'm just that bad. My PCOS is that bad. And I do like to reframe it a little bit in that case and say, well, it's not a problem with you. It's a problem with the medication you were given that you're now withdrawing from, essentially. That's like a form of, you know, sort of your body's been addicted to the medication. No, not addicted, but, you know, it's been suppressed by the medication. So then you have to go through this withdrawal process. So, yeah, so that's just a long-winded the preamble to what can we do instead, right? Which is a much bigger question. And I think step one is to reassure women that they're not broken. There are ways to lower androgens naturally. And through my lens, it starts with having the goal of reestablishing regular ovulation, because the estradiol and progesterone that we make with an ovulatory menstrual cycle have anti-androgen properties. Like I said, you know, our own female hormones are great anti-androgens, but we do want to promote them. And that means promoting ovulation through, you know, what we need to do, correcting, you know, the obstacles to ovulation, which in many, some cases is insulin resistance, some cases nutrient deficiency, right?
What's your experience with zinc? I read a study that 50 milligrams of zinc in women with PCOS for a duration of 8 weeks showed improvements in oxidative stress markers, which I thought was amazing. So great to see.
Yeah.
But what's your experience with this mineral? I personally love it for use in this space.
I've got the same, I think I've got that same study on my, one of my blog posts about zinc. Yeah. So it does, one of its mechanisms is it downregulates the 5-alpha reductase that we talked about that's been, that, you know, converts testosterone to DHT. So it's great. I mean, it's my, I'd say zinc is one of my top first supplements for androgen excess, for PCOS. And I always get the question, like, just to give the sort of sex differences here. So, you know, I've written that zinc can lower androgens in a good way in women. And then I get some of my readers coming back to me. It's like, well, they read somewhere that zinc can increase androgens in men. I'm like, it can. Because it's normalizing the system. So, yeah, I mean, but the fact that it can increase androgens in men doesn't mean it, you know, can't also lower them in women. It's normalizing.
Yeah, absolutely. You see that that balancing effect in many of our therapies, our nutrients, our herbs. It has that beautiful balancing effect.
Absolutely. Yeah. And also just to be clear, I mean, I also get the question, I say zinc can lower androgens and then people worry that it will push them too low. It's like, it won't do that. No, it won't. It's not going to push androgens below a normal level in women. I mean, there are safety issues. I mean, I think there's a limit on how much zinc to take. It's not like some is good, more is better, but, you know, lowering androgens too much is not one of the concerns.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. What about the herb Vitex? Now, I know from clinical experience it can work wonders in some people, but it can also make things worse. What are your treatment guidelines for using Vitex in the case of elevated androgens?
Well, the only time I really use it is when there's demonstrated higher than normal or high normal prolactin on a serum test. And that would be two prolactins, actually, because one, you have to, as you know, prolactin is a little bit reactive and tricky. You have to sort of test it under certain conditions. And a one-off high prolactin, you don't want to read too much into that. But if it's demonstrated, if people are running at a higher than normal level of prolactin, I find that's when Vitex works the best. I have, you know, for 25 years now, so I've been quite nervous about Vitex for other situations of androgen excess. because it can increase DHEA. Prolactin can increase DHEA. But yeah, so there are different clinicians out there that will use Vitex for PCOS under certain situations. One is my colleague Fiona McCulloch, mm-hmm. who has like, I think, a whole blog post on how to dose, when and how to dose Vitex for PCOS. So maybe I might refer people to that. I generally don't prescribe it for PCOS.
Likewise, I'm a little bit fearful of it. I've had a couple of cases when I was newer in clinical practice, and it just made things so much worse that I actually use it a lot less, I think, than the average practitioner as a result.
Yeah, for sure.
You mentioned reishi before, but I was reading some really great research when I was preparing for this episode on reishi and its anti-androgen properties. I wasn't aware of this. So do you use reishi? And if you do, what kind of doses are you looking at?
I mean, I don't use it, not because I don't think it's good.
Okay.
I think it's in some formulas. I may have prescribed it as part of other, combination formulas. The only reason I don't use it is just because I often have my radar on other things like zinc and inositol, of course, which we're going to have to talk about at some point.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's my main reason. But I think if there was a really good product out there and people were getting good results with reishi, I would say go for it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, great. So it's in our toolkit, but you prefer things like zinc and inositol. So let's go there with inositol.
Yeah.
What do you love about it?
Well, as you know, it's kind of a superstar for polycystic ovary syndrome. It actually made it into the international guidelines a few years ago, and I think they kept it in the guidelines in the latest version of those. But they're still sort of downplaying it and saying, it's not fully. I don't know what goalpost it would have to, sort of cross to be fully evidence based, because it's pretty close and it's had various clinical trials and meta analyses. Yeah, so it works both for improving ovulation, back to what I said about, ovulation is queen when it comes to lots of things, especially lowering androgen.
Mm.
It does that by amplifying, my understanding is it does that by amplifying the FSH message inside the cell. So inositol becomes part of the little intracellular messenger systems that amplifies the message of different hormones. So it amplifies FSH. It also amplifies insulin. So it can also, as well as having an ovulation promoting effect, it can improve insulin sensitivity, which is obviously another key part of what you need to do for PCOS. And I think that's one of the reasons it just does so well in clinical trials. It also amplifies TSH, it's my understanding. So it's also quite good for thyroid hormones. If you've got someone with a combination of maybe Hashimoto's, subclinical thyroid, insulin resistance, androgen excess, whether or not they've been diagnosed with PCOS, inositol is one of the ones to think about. I feel like I'm doing an infomercial whenever I talk about inositol because it's so inexpensive.
It is.
It's so safe.
Yeah.
And it's so inexpensive. It is like there's almost no downside. I guess the downside is you have to take quite a lot. So you need like probably between 4 to 6 grams per day. So you can't just, pop a little 100-milligram capsule and hope that's going to do anything.
So my question, Lara, around the dosage, 4 to 6 grams, I use it in a powder form, and I tend to dose twice a day to split it up. But how do you dose? What do you think gets the best results from a dose and time perspective?
I do exactly what you do.
Okay.
I would do 2 or 3 grams powder twice a day.
Yeah.
And I mean, some people don't like powders, which is fair, but it's too hard to do this one with capsules.
No,
so I just say to my patients, look, it tastes like nothing.
Mm.
You can take the second dose at bedtime because it also helps with neurotransmitter production and sleep. So I actually personally take inositol for sleep, and I don't, not for any, no, I mean, I maybe just to have some of the insulin sensitizing benefits as well.
Mm.
So yeah.
Yeah, I'm very grateful that it tastes so benign, because we do need to get it in at those doses to have the clinical effect. But the other thing I've noticed with it is that once patients start seeing the benefits and they start feeling it, they're very happy to take it twice a day and they don't forget.
Yeah, it's good. No, you're right. Actually, I found the same for people who are, once they're committed and just in the routine of taking it. It's good compliance with that supplement. And to be fair, just for people listening, missing the occasional dose is not a big deal with inositol. It's not like you know, if you have a day where they don't take it or they miss an evening dose, or it's fine. It's just generally trying to get it in at that level of, you know, 4 to 6 grams.
Yeah, exactly. Now, what about that classic herbal combination of peony and licorice? Do you use it?
Yeah.
Do you like using it? What kind of doses? Where does it come in from that toolkit side of things for
yeah.
you?
Yeah, I went through a phase of using it a lot, either as kind of liquid mix, this is back in when I was practicing in Sydney, mm-hmm. or, you know, there's a few, you know, practitioner brand supplements that has that combo. I have used it quite a lot, and I think it's good. And I think there's, as you know, there's a 2017 clinical trial using that combination.
Mm.
It works by different mechanisms. Actually, licorice is working on a whole other, it's sort of working on some other enzymes that produce androgens. It's down-regulating those. So I think it's good. I guess if I'm honest, though, it's kind of fallen off my prescribing palate plate, or what you call it,
yeah.
like just mainly because I'm just focused on the other things that we've just been talking about, you know, inositol, zinc, magnesium as well. Like I just find this, some, I guess in terms of cost and ease and
yeah.
just everything, I'm trying to get patients onto, you know, some of the other supplements because the other thing that this is worth repeating, this is a long-term strategy. I mean, inositol is a supplement for years, potentially.
Yeah.
So you have to prepare people for that. You could, back to the peony and licorice, what I have done sometimes is maybe use that for just 6 months to kind of really get things going, get ovulation going, but not consider that, you know, as long-term. And in that case, that's better because then it's typically more expensive than inositol, for example, but you could just use it for a while. And to be fair, you can easily combine peony and licorice combo with inositol and with zinc. It's not an either-or situation.
Yeah, exactly. There's one other strategy I'd like to discuss with you from a treatment perspective, which is the diindolmethane, which you mentioned a bit earlier.
Yeah.
Tell us about your clinical experience, your thoughts around using this.
Well, the way I came to this supplement, of course, I know the supplement, you know, from years ago as an estrogen clearing, you know, supplement to potentially upregulate some of the estrogen detoxification pathways. But then I just had a lot, about 15 years ago, I had just lots of patients using it for, that was before TikTok, so I don't know where they'd learned about it, but like using it for acne.
Mm.
And I was discovering it does seem to work very well for that. And the only, as with many of these supplements, there's very little research. And the only thing I could sort of discover, maybe you have more to share on this, but I think it can, at the right dose, down regulate 5-alpha reductase. So again, down regulate that DHT production. It may also interact with androgen receptors potentially. I don't think there's concrete evidence of that. And the sweet spot seems to be about 100 milligrams per day. I don't like to go much higher just because I think it can deplete estrogen.
Mm.
Do you have anything to add to that? What's your experience with?
I've gone, you know, high dose for some patients, lower dose for other patients. And to be honest, there's a bit of a mixed bag of results. And I think it's because there's so much else going on in these patients that's contributing
yeah.
to that result. I am more conservative about it now. I actually had a patient email me yesterday saying, oh, Emmy, you've prescribed me 45 milligrams of DIM. I've read on this side I should be taking at least 200 milligrams. Like, no, I specifically want you on a lower dose. So I do go lower dose these days. I just think the less that you use to get the result, the better.
Agree. Yeah, I can see tending to a lower, yeah. Like, I don't like to go over 100, but lower is fine.
Yeah. Yeah, fantastic. So we have a lot in our toolkit when we're treating excess androgens. We have zinc, we have myo-inositol, we have diindolmethane. One that we didn't discuss, but I'd love to do a brief wrap on this as an end question, is magnesium, because we use it
yeah.
so much, but it does come in many different forms. What kind of forms and what kind of doses do you like to use for androgen excess?
Yeah, we're kind of living in the golden age of magnesium. I mean, how many new formulations are there? I
just yeah.
like, there's all ones with different herbs. And so, yeah, really good question. I think in terms of lowering androgens, its main thing is that it's a strong insulin sensitizer. So it's definitely happening on the insulin side of things. It does also just stabilize the nervous system. So it can, I think, reduce adrenal androgen overexposure, overproduction. It activates vitamin D. It helps with promote healthy ovulation. So then you're getting progesterone coming on board with its anti-androgen. mechanisms. So would you, is there anything you'd add to that in terms of ways that it can help lower androgens?
I wonder whether it has an effect on the sensitivity of the receptors. Like that's, mechanism unknown, but I have a strong feeling that it does.
That makes total sense because we talked about how inflammation can upregulate androgen sensitivity, receptor sensitivity. Absolutely, magnesium is anti-inflammatory. I typically use the magnesium glycinate formulas with added taurine and various other things. I think there's even one now with inositol built right into it. All the brands have some good magnesium powders and a variety of them.
Yeah.
So I would often select it based on, like, if someone needs extra help for sleep, then I'd pick one that's formulated more for sleep, or if they're needing it more for kind of cardiovascular, I'll get one of the daytime ones with taurine and other things. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And what about dose for magnesium? How many milligrams would you prefer to use?
Yeah, I mean, I just usually aim for the classic 300 milligram therapeutic dose. And people do, I mean, practitioners know all about this, but, you know, the public needs to know how to read the label because depending on how it's listed on the label, it might be listing the whole thing of magnesium bisglycinate, like quite a large number of milligrams of that, but that's only providing, 100 milligrams of elemental magnesium. Basically. I think people know what I mean. You have to kind of read through the label and figure out how much actual magnesium is being delivered.
Yeah, and I have a big bugbear with that because magnesium is probably my most prescribed nutrient, and I always have patients either email me pictures of the supplements they've already bought, or I get them to bring them into clinic and I explain to them, I take them through the labels and I explain to them and literally 100% of the time they look at me and they're shocked at how little magnesium is in the supplement that they've been purchasing. And it's really important that we as practitioners are educating our patients on how to be literate in reading labels.
Exactly. A good rule of thumb, it's pretty much impossible to get 300 milligrams of magnesium from one capsule or tablet.
Yeah.
I mean, there might be, if it's just like a straight magnesium oxide or something, then maybe, and that's likely going to be quite strongly laxative. But with the better magnesium, you're going to need at least 3 capsules or a scoop of powder or something like that.
Yeah, beautiful. And just to finish off, Lara, I've really loved this conversation. Any out-of-the-box thinking or emerging research that you've come across when you wrote your book in this space that you want to share with us?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've got the 3 books. My latest one is about metabolic health. And I do talk quite a bit about androgen excess in that book, actually, and the different scenarios that we've been talking about.
Yeah.
PCOS, perimenopause. I guess one thing I would say, a takeaway from my deep dive into metabolic health and my book is that it's cliche, but it really is true. It's very multifactorial. Lots of things affect insulin sensitivity. It's not just dialing in the perfect diet and perfect exercise regime, because if it was just that, then everyone would be fine, right? Like we'd have it all sorted. But as we know, as naturopaths, everything is connected with everything. And definitely insulin sensitivity and metabolic health is affected by lots of different factors, especially gut health. And that's the one I wanted to tie in, because there's been quite a bit of new research linking in how gut microbes and bile acid production in the gut and like bile acid metabolism is directly speaking to things like mitochondria and the cells that produce GLP-1, the famous satiety weight loss hormone. That's a gut hormone. Yeah. And there was just a study that found that certain strains of gut bacteria orchestrate that, is the word the scientists use, directly stimulate those cells. So like I said in my other, I give the analogy in my first book, I'm like, if you want to fix your period, you need to fix your general health.
Yeah.
And I would say for metabolism, to fix your metabolism, you need to, in very many cases, fix your general health. Like look at, is there a food sensitivity? Is there a gut problem? Like shift your focus to that. And downstream from that, you'll just spontaneously very often get results in terms of naturally reduced hunger, naturally increased energy expenditure, like a weight that just drifts down without having to micromanage it.
Fantastic. And such a great reminder on the concept of holism and how we are not pieces that are in silos. Our systems work together in harmony, and we need to keep our framework like that.
Exactly. Well said.
Well, wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us today, Lara. I've really enjoyed this conversation. Now, I know you've got a couple of resources that we'll put in the show notes, and the audience will also be able to find a full transcript of the episode on the website. Any last words from you, Lara?
No, just how great it was to, you know, speak to a sister naturopath. Yeah, it was fun. It was great. Thanks, Emma.
Beautiful. Fun is one of my biggest things in life. So have a great rest of your day. Now, everyone else, don't forget that you can find all the show notes, transcripts, and other resources from today's episode on the FX Medicine by Bioceuticals website. I'm Emma Sutherland. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time. This podcast is intended as healthcare practitioner education only, and it is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to FX Medicine, and share us with your family, friends, and colleagues.